Today's episode of Creative Minds is brought to you by Audible.com. It's always Audible.com, just like what's in my ears is always either a podcast or Audible.com. I go through about 2 audiobooks a week. I wish it was more, but then I wouldn't get anything else done. Right now, what am I listening to? Right now, I'm listening to How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan. It's a book that former guest and friend Colin Frangicetto recommended to me. And so far, it's just super fascinating. It's basically a history of psychedelics, or I should say a history of the modern study of psychedelics and how it actually works in the brain and what it can do for the brain, including healing as well as mystical experiences. It's really, really fascinating. And it, for the first time, it made me want to write a nonfiction book. And if you remember last week, I said I was also reading High Magic by Damien Eccles. This is kind of going to be like Hawaii, not because it's long, but because it's something that I'm going to be reading over time because it's more of an exercise book. There's a lot of breathing exercises and stuff like that that I need to take my time to go through this book. So if you're interested in either of these books, or maybe you just love me and you want to support, I can't even get away with saying that, or maybe you just love these podcasts and you want to help support what I'm doing, you can go to audibletrial.com/holyfool and sign up for that free trial. It's 30 days. You get a free book, so you could get one of those. You can get something else. You should go over there and sign up. And when you do, tweet, Instagram, Facebook, email, whatever, carrier pigeon, send me a message and tell me what book you picked because I'm a bookworm and I love hearing this stuff. Maybe you want to support more in a different way. Well, I've got a place for you to do that as well. It's called Patreon. You've probably heard of it. So if you head over to patreon.com/holyfoolproductions, you can become a patron. And in reality, for less than what people spend in one morning on a pumpkin spice latte at Starbucks, you can support the future of Holy Fool. So I finally got around to watching The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling, which both Colin Frangicetto and Megan Holiday recommended that I watch. And yes, they were right. Of course, they were right. It's fantastic. What it actually did is it woke something up inside of me. And I'll go into that maybe as it develops further. But it sparked an interest in me that is completely outside of everything that I do publicly. So it's given me a private interest, which I haven't had in a long time. And along with that, what I did is I wanted to go back and watch some of Gary's shows. And I was coincidentally already watching the Larry Sanders Show, which is the fake talk show that he did in the 90s. But what I wanted to watch was it's Gary Shandling's show, which is his older show from the 80s that he got most of his fame from that show. And it broke a lot of the rules of the sitcom that now are commonplace, but it broke the fourth wall, if you know what that is. He talked to us, to the audience, and the characters were aware that they were on a TV show. And I found it on iTunes. I've been watching it, and it is really funny. I don't think it's aged at all. I think, if anything, like the fashion and everything like that makes it more interesting. But in watching that, he comes out at the beginning of each of those shows, and he talks to the audience for, I don't know, about 2 or 3 minutes. And he says in one of them, "This is my monologue." And I realized he was, of course, referencing talk shows, because if you watch the documentary, all he ever wanted to do was to host The Tonight Show. So he used that idea of the opening monologue where they come out and they talk to the audience before the show begins. And it hit me for the first time that, oh my God, that's what this is. That's what everybody on podcasts do when they talk before an episode. They don't even realize it maybe, but they're doing an opening monologue. Now, of course, these aren't funny because, well, I'm not that funny. I'm more of a serious person. I make myself laugh. But I don't know that I'm a comedian. Actually, I do know I am not a comedian. But these are opening monologues, and I realized that connection there. And that was a really fascinating thing because it gave me another connection to why so many of the most successful early podcasters have been stand-up comedians or comedians in general, because the format is so familiar to them. Not to mention they're already skilled at talking in front of audiences, so sitting in front of a microphone is no big deal for them. But I don't know, just a really interesting connection. I wanted to share that with you guys. But more than anything, go watch the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling's two-part documentary. And then after that, or at least after the first one, go watch It's Gary Shandling's Show. It's pretty funny. So let's spin that around and let's talk a little bit about today's guest. Today's guest is Erin Salazar. And Erin does something that just completely blows my mind. She does murals. You know, I talk about it a little bit in the episode. I know how to draw on paper. I can scale things down in size, but the idea of scaling something bigger and these big scales of whole walls on the sides of buildings, it just seems so far beyond what I think I could capably do. And the way she explains how she does it makes it sound just really simple. And I think for her, it just is. Some people just have that magic brain. And she also helps other people do murals, and she knows how to organize all of it. And she's, and I think when you listen to this, you're gonna hear how much fun she is. She's just a really fun person to talk to. She's really funny and actually really, really, really open. I mean, when we start this episode, we started deep. I mean, pretty much from the moment I hit record, we are already deep. And that's a very special kind of person that can open up like that to a stranger immediately. So I hope you guys enjoy this episode. And I don't ever say this, but I hope you share it. I hope you share this with somebody else that will enjoy it. So for whoever's listening right now, enjoy my conversation with Erin Salazar. I'm an introvert. I don't know if you're an introvert, but I get a little bit nervous before each one of these. And I thrive off of that nervousness. But do you ever, like, when you do interviews like this, or I don't know if you've done podcasts before, but I know you've done written interviews, like with content, do you get nervous before them?
I think I used to. I do so much of it now that, like, I just try to be, like, bigger than my whatever is making me nervous, essentially.
Hmm.
Because I have to give, like, a lot of talks from time to time, you know, where I have to, like, stand up on stage and, like, kind of be a little bit, like, bare my soul a little bit. And sometimes that, like, reaction is a little nerve-wracking, but I think not so much.
Do you think you're an introvert or an extrovert?
I don't know. I have no idea what I don't know, is both or neither? I don't know.
Some people say that there's an ambivert, which is the mix of the two.
Oh, ambivert.
I don't know if you know Mike McGee. That's a term he uses a lot.
Oh, I do know Mike McGee. He's on our board.
Ah.
Excellent. Ambivert, huh? That's a good one. Yeah, I definitely, like, I live by myself and, you know, like, I like that quietness, and I like to come home and just, like, not do anything.
When you had to start going on stage and doing things on stage, were you practiced in that, or did you have to actually learn that skill?
I've always liked doing it. I've always been pretty good at it. You know, like, all through, like, college, like, I loved giving presentations. Through high school, I really liked it as well. I don't have that that fear that some people talk about when they talk about public speaking.
So before you do something like that, is there, like, a ritual or something you go through? You have to hype yourself up, or you're just ready to go the moment it's time to go on stage?
I'm usually pretty ready to go.
Wow.
I don't, like, ritual anything. Like, I suppose if there's a glass of wine handy, I'll have a glass of wine or beer or something. And that'll usually, like, I'll just, like, get loose, you know?
And when you say you're going up there to bare your soul, like, can you break that down a little bit more so that we can understand what you mean? Like, what are you talking about up there?
Yeah. So I think sometimes when we do this work, right, like, we do this heartfelt, very nonprofit-y work. And for me, like, where the work comes from is a huge part of how I tell the story. And I like to tell stories. So when I go up there and I'm on stage and I have to talk about, like, you know, why is this work important? You know, I'm trying to sell people on me, the individual. And so my story has a lot to do with that. In 2011, I'm originally from the Mojave Desert and I moved here a bunch of years ago. And when I go up there to tell my story, it almost always includes the death of my parents. I lost my dad in 2011 and my mom in 2012. And it was a really, really hard year for me, but I just felt like, you know, they died when they were 55. They were pretty young. And I was a little bit more nihilistic, you know, at like 24 or so, that I thought if they died when they were 55, then I'm pretty much halfway over, like my life is halfway over too. I was just being super negative then. And I thought that I could be more impactful working for other people than I could be than by just working for myself. And so I kind of started the nonprofit based around the idea that I'd be helping other artists do their thing and do it well and safely.
Is it a strange thing that you know, like for grief is usually it's something very personal. Is it a strange thing to have to go through that in a public way on a continual basis? You know, like even right now you had to kind of explain that to break it down. Is it weird to continually be, I don't know, rehashing, but just retelling that story that's so personal?
Yeah, it is. It is. Especially because they're like strangers who know things about me. Like, I don't know anything about you, but I'm on stage trying to tell you like why this is important, why this is important to me. And it does. It like, some days are easier than others. Like sometimes I'll get a little choked up, but I'm not afraid of that being a part of the story, a part of my, you know, my story, the story of the company. And, it is weird to have to share that, but it's so important. Like it's vital to the starting of the company. Cause I feel like everything that I do now is kind of sort of to honor them or to like, you know, I think that we try to impress our parents and, I don't really have anybody left to impress. And so to like get up on stage, maybe I'm like sort of trying to impress everybody else, you know?
Yeah. I imagine like there's a scene from a TV show that's like long forgotten what TV show it was or whatever, but it stuck in my head and they were talking about, it was two men talking about the death of the father and this idea that like that you're on a ladder and that all of a sudden when your parent dies, you realize like, oh, I'm the top rung of the ladder now. There's nothing above me. What is that like to go through? Like to really just like you said, not necessarily the grief, because I know you go through talking about that a lot, but I mean the process of realizing that there's nobody that you're responsible to, quote unquote, above you.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think I'm the oldest in my family. I've got two older brothers, but they have a different father. But as far as like my mother and my father's kids, I'm their oldest. And so to me, I feel like now I am like at the ripe old age of 31, like the matriarch of my part of the family. And some of that feels like a little bit ego-y just to say out loud. But the other part of it is like the very real responsibilities that come with that. Like I have to remind all the siblings like, hey, it's Cody's birthday. Hey, like don't forget to text Todd. It's, you know, he's got an anniversary coming up, you know. So I have to like, I'm now like in charge of that role. And like tangibly, all of those like dumb certificates you get as a kid for, you know, track and field or, you know, best art competition, all of that like crap that just lives at your parents' house, I have all of everybody's crap now. And so it's like having actual baggage to take with.
So you basically, you become like the repository of history.
Yeah. I'm the historian now, basically. And I have so many questions about like where we came from, like what my parents like were doing when they were my age. You know, I have all these questions that I'll never ever have answers to. So it's kind of interesting because I definitely would not be doing the work that I'm doing now had they not like passed away and that not had that like really traumatic impact on my life, because and I'm thankful for that. And that's kind of weird too.
That's interesting that you say that. I had a conversation on this show with my friend Giovanni, and he talked about something very similar. His father died when he was in high school. And he says that like, because of his father's death, he didn't feel like he would be making music and doing what he's doing now if his father hadn't died. And I mean, what is it like to have that complex, you know, like that? I mean, those are completely at odds with each other in a way emotionally, you know, like is there a guilt to that?
Oh, totally. Absolutely. And like the guilt has kind of subsided now, because I think that guilt is just like something that your brain makes up for you to stress about. And I definitely felt really guilty for a long time about like being thankful that like they were really sick. They both had cancer. They're big drinkers. So they wasted themselves away. And part of me feels like a little bit bad even about that part of it. But I don't know. There's something that's like, so like, I feel like they gave me a gift of not having to worry about them anymore.
And did the way that they died, did that affect your relationship to alcohol in any way? Like, did you like go through like a disgust phase or something like that?
No, I would say no, not really. I think seeing like it, oh man, it, college was one thing. And then when you keep that party rolling after college, you know, my folks didn't go to school or anything like that, but just to see the after effect of like what that level of like substance abuse can do was pretty hard to watch, and has definitely slowed me down. But you know, like they're drinking Coors Lights and I'm having, you know, like a fine IPA with like a delightful, grapefruit finish, you know.
And it's like four Coors Lights in one glass.
Yeah, a little dip. So then I can only have two.
Going back to being on stage and rehashing some of, or not necessarily rehashing, but discussing this in front of people, there's a story of Paul Simon when he wrote The Bridge Over Troubled Waters, which is, to him, it was about his relationship with Carrie Fisher, and it's a very emotional song for him. Like, he couldn't even sing it himself. And he talks about how having to do that song and like that being their song, it kind of, in some way, it ruined his relationship to that song, because he did it so often he could no longer feel it anymore. Yeah. Do you ever feel that that's going to, in some way, obviously, you're never going to stop feeling the grief of your parents, but you're going to disassociate with the story in some way?
I'm pretty scared of that happening, because I have to tell the story so often. And I'm scared of that happening, because once it becomes just like words falling out of my mouth, then it's like, then I'll feel like I'm just pimping this story, you know?
And how does one even begin to like define what that line is where you go, oh, I'm starting to get there? You think it's just an emotional thing, or you think there's actually like a limit on it? Like, okay, I've been doing this for 2 years. That's enough.
No, I don't know. It just seems so important to me. You know, it seems important to say, and I have to, like, that's my responsibility, is to not let that become so commonplace that I stop feeling it. Like that's just me. Like, I think that I have to remember to not take this for granted.
How do you, I mean, even begin to go about doing that? Is it like some personal rituals or something? You know, like you have your, you know, like, okay, this is my practice conversation of this topic, but I need this time alone where I do these things, because that reminds me what it really feels like.
Yeah, I think I definitely, when you were talking about like ritualistic things, like when I have big meetings or something like that, I'll have what I call a ceremonial cry. And so I think that I just, it's important for me to remember to take specific time to honor their contribution to my life and to be just like really mindful. So that way it doesn't come off automatic or fake or anything like that. When I'm giving this presentation, it's still, I still feel it, but I think, being able to set time aside to give them what they're owed, has been really important to me.
And we've kind of been dancing on the periphery of the company, but do you want to explain what the company is and why you think that this message is so core to explaining it and why you feel like you need to continually tell people that story?
Because I think storytelling and people being vulnerable builds empathy. And I'm really into building empathy for the arts and through the arts. And I think that it's a compelling narrative. So I run a nonprofit and it's called the Exhibition District. And started in 2014. And I just started with the goal to create these economic opportunities for artists through city beautification. So primarily through murals and stuff like that. And then we added a secondary program called Local Color, where we're working to reactivate some of the buildings in San Jose that are slated for demo as creative spaces for artists. So we do shows and open mics, and we have like 30 artists working in there as with, you know, subsidized studio spaces. And so like, that's a kind of like an overview of what the company does. And I feel that, that part, the death of my parents is relevant because I came up to San Jose to go to San Jose State for art and design, and got my degree, graduated, and I was doing murals, like interior commissions, like for Cafe Stritch and Good Karma and Original Gravity. And so I started like pulling in all of these like mural gigs. And then after and I was really like trying to help support them in a lot of what my parents, that is, sending money home and stuff like that. And so after they had passed away, I had taken pretty considerable time off of like work and life to kind of like deal, to like cope with that whole situation. And so it was then when I thought that like I could be more impactful working for other people than if I was just working for myself. So that's kind of like, it was just one of those like life check-in things where it's like, hey, real shit just got real. And now I have to like get the work done. There's real work to do.
And for all the people listening, will definitely recognize the name Local Color, because the previous episodes we've had Ben and Drew both on.
Oh, cool.
Yes. I love you guys. So Local Color is heavily represented in this season of the podcast.
That's awesome. That's my baby, my big 20,000 square foot humongous baby.
Yeah, and that used to be a Ross, right?
It was. It was a Ross, and it was Black Sea Gallery, and then before that it was Woolworths.
And how did you get the idea to take, you know, like basically a gutted Ross and then make it into a creative space?
I was with, I did this really amazing fellowship with National Art Strategies. And so every month you had to do a certain amount of like quote unquote homework. And so it's like walk around your city, take stock of everything that's there, you know, just these little kind of assignments. And one of them, I was watching this lecture at like 1.5 speed, because I wanted to get through it. And so it's going really fast. And I'm like, I'm trying to listen and pay attention, but I'm also trying to do like 6 other things because I think, I don't know, I'm bad at that. And I caught this little nugget kind of like out of the corner of my ear. And the lecturer was like, we need to start defining our communities through their assets and not their deficits. And I was like, well, that's really interesting. Like, those are words that really reflect like how I feel. And the idea of being like kind of recycling, resourcefulness, being really scrappy, trying new things. I don't censor myself or like say, no, I shouldn't do that. Like I'll definitely like jump in 2 feet, both feet, all the time. But I just thought, instead of getting pissed off about like all of the empty buildings and all of the blank walls, which is kind of what we were already doing, we turned them into canvases. So for me, it was just really like a perspective shift. And so instead of being pissed off about something, it's just another opportunity to like test or try. So I have a bunch of artists who needed studio spaces who I wanted to help, and the community needs a cool place to gather. San Jose has a lack of free things to do, in my opinion. And I wanted to be one of those cool free things. So then I was looking around First Street basically has been like my stomping ground. I worked at Good Karma. My little sister works at OG. Like I know all these like bar and restaurant people in the industry. And so when Ross closed down, I was just like, I would think about it, and there was something there, and I'd think about it, and I knew that there was something there. So I started pacing, and usually when I'm pacing, that means I'm onto something. And I was just like, what if we could get this building? What if we could move in artists? Like what if we had like a little stage, or we could do art classes, and we could do this, we could do that. And so like the idea could just kind of kept growing and growing and growing until it was into fruition. And I think from the time I said it out loud to myself and to like a bunch of other people, to when we got the keys to the building, was so fast. It was like 2 weeks or something like that. It was so fast.
Wow.
So we didn't even have time to like, I mean, we were exhausted. The whole team was just like fried, and we gutted it. We got the keys like in December, the 1st of December. And then we gutted all of the metal off the wall. We fixed everything up. We repainted, we stapled and spit shined everything basically. And that was about 2 weeks turnaround. So we were really, I mean, there was like 15 of us going like whole in on it.
Was it super gnarly in there when you guys first got in?
No, it was really creepy. Like, it's just so clean, like so white, you know? It wasn't too gnarly, except for they had all the metal, the racks and stuff on the walls that we had to pull off. And we pulled out almost 2 tons of metal.
Wow. Surprised they didn't take that kind of stuff with them.
Well, I think it was just more expensive for them to do that. To send the labor over to do it, then they just fireballed it. They just left it there.
That's like, there's over on down on Tenet, there's all these buildings, these huge buildings that corporations used to be in, and they're all vacant. And they've been vacant for like 5 to 10 years. And I asked somebody one time, I'm like, why are these buildings vacant? And they're like, well, they make more money off of the insurance for the building being vacant than they do to like reoccupy them.
It's so shitty too, right? Because they're just like blighting entire neighborhoods by doing that.
And and they still have like gardeners going out there and like blowing the parking lots. It's stupid.
What a like gratuitous like waste of, ugh, that grosses me out so much. I think sometimes developers can be so shitty.
Did you have to like negotiate that kind of stuff with the owners of that building? You know, like, were they weighing that like, well, we're making this much off of the, no, I don't know if they have what that insurance policy is even called, to be honest. But I mean, what was that negotiation process like?
It was so easy. And I know that this is going to be, it's totally unique to these property owners specifically. They used to run a furniture gallery. They're these really nice people. Well, they're businessy people, but they're, you know, they're kind of nice. And hell, they're letting us use their building. So that's pretty nice. It was pretty easy to do. We got in contact with them through our partnership with the Downtown Association, because I'd been doing a lot of the mural work and like fundraising and paying artists and doing murals that we worked pretty closely together. And so when I pitched this idea to them, then they were able to connect directly to the property owners, who are already pretty arts sympathetic. And they were more than happy to let us kind of just steward the building. So we really feel like we are caretakers of that building.
Sounds like a kismet situation where you just like the perfect storm.
It was perfect. I couldn't believe how fast, like then I was like, oh man, what did I get myself into? Because everything happened so fast. And like, now I'm doing like building operations. And I have an arts degree. Like, I'm a waitress, you know? And I know I eventually have to stop saying that, but like, I don't know. I think back and I'm just like, man, I was just like bartending and like being just kind of a little shithead around downtown. And then I had this idea, and then the idea had two ideas. And now I know more than I would ever care to know about dumpster rentals and how to deal with like 30 eccentric, lively people all working in one building. So sensitive. They're so sensitive.
That brings up a really interesting point too. You know, like, I feel like there are a lot of people, we know that there are a lot of people out there that are just, you know, kind of doing jobs that necessarily aren't fulfilling who they are. They're just jobs. You know, like you said, waitressing or bartending. For a lot of people, those jobs are just about making the money. You know, they don't dream to be necessarily a bartender or a waitress, not to disparage the people who do. But those same people also have ideas, like you did. What do you think gave you the faith to actually like leap, to actually do it?
I think it was just because I had, what do I have to lose? You know, at that point I was just like, I felt so much like I needed to just stop doing like mundane average shit and just be like extra. Like, I know that it's there and it's in me. I've always, always, always felt that way.
So you think it was like this, there's like a line, you know, like you crossed it and you're like, okay, this is it. It's time now.
And it really was the when my mom passed away, my dad passed away first, and my mom passed away. And I was just like, what am I doing with my life? I have 25 years left to live. And what am I doing with it? I'm bartending. I love bartending. I love grapefruit IPAs. Like, I love a good sour, but like, I just really was able to take that leap because if the worst thing that had, I'm going to get a little emotional. If the worst thing that could happen had already happened, like, what else was there to be scared of? Like, I don't get the building. Like, we don't get funding. Like, wah, like, I already did the hardest shit in the whole world. Knock on wood. And like, there's just nothing left to be afraid of after going through that.
So it really, I mean, it truly is interwoven into the story of everything, because it was your kick.
Yeah, it was a huge kick. It was like a donkey kick.
And I wouldn't worry that you're getting desensitized to it, because it's obvious that you aren't.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about murals. We've mentioned that a few times. What led you to that? I mean, that, like, most people would look at a mural and go, I have no idea how that happens. How do you end up being a muralist?
I was working. So my dream several years ago was to like be an artist. Like, I was going to make all of this really dope work, like show it, you know, across the United States and all these beautiful galleries. And I was just going to be this like debutante of like punk rock art. And then that's a really, really hard to do. And I didn't want to do it anymore. And I needed to make money, because at this point I was kind of, I was pretty significantly underhoused. I was living in a warehouse down below 280, south of 280. And I just needed to like make rent like really, really bad. And I just moved my sister up here from Southern California. She got in a little bit of trouble, Cody. And and I brought her up here because she needed a fresh start. So when I was living in this warehouse and I needed to make more money, or I at least needed to not spend money on food. So I was working at Good Karma at the time. And I told Ryan, well, we came up with this idea that I was going to paint the ceiling. Didn't end up painting the ceiling. I painted panels on the floor and then moved them to the ceiling. But I got like, you know, 50% cash, 50% trade. And so I eat at Good Karma. You know, I wanted to have places where I could like go to take a client and say, this is my work. can I get you lunch? And it would just go on this forever tab. And so I kind of just like fell into my lap. And once I did that one, then I was like, oh, mural girl. Went down to Cafe Stritch and I did a couple of their murals. And then I don't know, I think I was just like easy to hire for mural work too. And it was just a lot of fun. I really enjoyed doing it. And I think that I have both the talent to be able to, or the practice I should say, to be able to paint murals. And also the other side of the brain that deals with the insurance and budgeting for materials and renting equipment and all of that stuff that comes with it. And so I wanted to share that value with other artists who are not so good sometimes with the insurance and the budgeting and the safety.
How do you begin to like wrap your head around the scale? You know, because it, like drawing something, I think, you know, going smaller, we kind of inherently understand, but going bigger is something that maybe it's for most people is just beyond comprehension.
Yeah, I think, and part of that is the fear of it too, right? Like if you just gotta do it. You just gotta jump in. And like, I think as artists, like you know how to do it. You know how to paint. You're just painting with like a really big brush now and on a really big surface. And I think the only thing that's really scary is like the heights sometimes, but also the time. Being able to estimate the time that it'll take to do something like that. And I mean, other than that, it's just careful planning. You could do anything. It's just paint.
And the first one you did, how many times did you have to go get more paint?
I did a really good job on that one. So maybe like one or two times, but on the, on the Vida Abundante mural on the Dienza Hotel, we definitely had to go back several times. Cause it's like a 3,000 square foot wall.
I feel like if I approached that, I would go in and be like, oh, this will work. You know, one can will cover it. No, it's like one.
Yeah, it was a lot of like multiplying square footage times, you know, this many gallons plus this little cover this much square feet. And so it's just estimating how much paint you'll need and then like adding 50% to that.
And there's an interesting point too. So there's some mathematics involved in it for sure.
Yeah, that's a, you know, I would be kicking myself if I heard myself say this like years ago, but I really like doing the budgeting and the spreadsheets for it. I think it's so fun, or it's like at least rewarding.
There's something about, you know, like I'm a to-do list person. Like I love to-do lists and stuff like that. There's something about those tangible, you're taking these abstract ideas and you're putting it into something tangible, you know, like money. Okay, now I have a budget. There's something satisfying about that.
Yeah. And I just think that like laying out your plans too is because you can do almost anything. You just got to like, this is my goal and these are the steps I need to take. And you just go through the steps and then you have your outcome.
I'm going to rehash a, I guess this would be a third hand story now. So one of our previous guests, Alicia Oxy, interviewed somebody on her podcast. And he was telling a story about, he was at some event and he was sitting next to a millionaire or a billionaire. I'm not sure which one. Either way, the guy looked over at him at one point. And he said, you know, the difference between me and all these people in the room, I plan.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really powerful because it's like, it's just like you said, it's about those concrete things, you know, like the steps, like, okay, here's my plan. I put it down. I can accomplish this because I see how it fits together.
Yeah. You buy the paint. You rent the scissor lift, you tell your insurance agent, you know, there's ways to do it. You know, how am I going to get my drawing like that big on the side of this wall? Like, well, we got a couple of options. We can do it. We can drop a grid, which is a pain in the ass. We could take your design and we could project it, which is something that we've done to get the outline. There's all sorts of different ways to like make something happen.
Do you think, like, I get the feeling sometimes I look at the current state of, like, society, and I feel like we have so much technology to make things easier, but do you ever feel like they make so many things to make things easier that when it comes down to do something like that, which you're not really, there's not really a program that's going to do those things for you. You have to use your actual brain. Yeah. Do you ever feel like that's what deters people is, like, that, oh, I have to think now, and that's going to be tiring. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, well, it's uncomfortable, right? Like, it's uncomfortable to have to, like, math. And, well, for me anyways. And then, like, and remember to feed myself and stay hydrated. You know, it's like asking a lot of a person or of, like, a group. But it's totally doable. And I think that some people just get afraid of the scale, you know, the scale and scope of what goes into, like, and maybe that's being extra, right? Like, maybe that's being extra. It's being beyond, like, I don't want to say extraordinary because, like, that feels ego-y too, but, like, if that's what it takes, and it's not even that much to like get outside of what's comfortable.
I think extraordinary is the right word because, I mean, we use extraordinary as like this term of like grandiose, you know, greatness, but all it really means is beyond the ordinary.
Just a little, even a little bit.
Right. You know, like the person who works, you know, 10-hour shifts and then goes home and writes for 30 minutes, that's extraordinary because they're doing something out of the ordinary. They're not just, you know, comatosing themselves and going to bed.
Uh-huh.
It takes a lot. And I know that, like, a lot of people out there, they struggle with that. I think everybody does. Even the people who succeed and do things, they still struggle with it. I mean, you read enough stories about novelists and they talk about how people think, oh, you wrote one book, you can write more. No, every book is as difficult as the first one was.
Yeah.
How do you battle those things? You know, like, how do you keep yourself motivated?
I think I do a little bit more like personal sacrificing. I don't always feed myself. I don't always keep myself hydrated like a little houseplant. For me personally, I have to get some studio time in. Actually tomorrow night, Thursday night is like where I'm going to go and I'm going to get some painting done. But if I don't get like the creative time in where I can like creatively like kind of express myself through visual arts, then like I'm not going to be successful or thoughtful or creative when it comes to my work. Like I really do need both.
There's an adage in Hollywood that they say when you're making a movie, there's time, money, and quality. Pick two because you never get all three.
Yeah, I think money's out for the nonprofit.
Well, I feel like even going back to what you're just saying there, there's like a different triad for everyone. You know, it's like there's needs, you know, like feeding yourself and paying the bills. And then there's personal life, you know, like love life or friends and things like that. And then there's dreams. Pick two.
It's so hard.
And it really does feel like that sometimes.
Well, it's kind of like, you know what it is? It's almost like, okay, if we think about the other side of that triad, right? Like so what I'm trying to get at is, do you remember playing like a game called Bang, Marry, Kill?
No.
You pick three of your friends. You have to assign them bang, marry, kill. And it's kind of the same. It's kind of the same thing. I don't know why I just thought about that, but that's really funny.
Now everybody's going to be Googling that.
Bang, marry, kill. It's a really easy game. With the winners.
When you approach murals, what is the process? You know, like what do you have to do before you even begin?
Ooh, okay. Yes, this is a good topic. So before we start a mural, we have to find a wall. We have to find a property owner behind the wall that is willing to let us do some work. And we have to find funding. And the funding part is like the boring part. That's the other half of my job, which is grant writing. But the real fun part comes with like meeting all of these interesting characters who play a vital role in San Jose, and they're the property owners. So I get to meet a lot of these property people, and sometimes they've had buildings here for a long time, and so that's really exciting. We work only with independent property owners and not with city-owned buildings because that's just like a nightmare. And we usually start with a sketch, and we bring the sketch that sits on top of the wall, like a picture of the wall, basically. So we have like a rendering. We come to them first, like instead of saying, hey, can we do a mural here? We say, this is the mural that we'd like to paint here. Do you have any feedback for us? And is this going to be okay with you? So that way we're like skipping a whole part of the question, which is like asking if we can, then going back and forth for like 2 months about timelines and this and that. So we just like skip a bunch of stuff and say, this is what we'd like to paint. Is this okay with you? If so, I need you to sign here. And then we go into all of the collection of the materials and the equipment facilitation, which is also kind of fun because I get to drive around in a like a articulated boom lift 4x4 or like really rad scissor lift. And just like playing with all that equipment makes me feel like such a badass. And then we buy all of our materials and we just get out there and get it done.
So when you say you do a sketch, is that a paper sketch first before you do the rendering?
Usually. Some artists like to work on a tablet. Some artists like to work on paper. I'm an old fashioned. I like to like draw it out, draw the shape of the wall, the size and everything like that. Some people will just take a picture of it and just like be able to draw directly on top of the picture, which is amazing.
When you take yours, since they are on paper, are you using Photoshop to do the renders or what?
I am woefully inadequate at using creative software. I have to outsource that actually. we do. So you mentioned Ben. Sometimes Ben will help us out with these renderings because he's really, really good at it. Other times I'll get one of the other artists to be like, hey, can you do me a favor? Can you just put this image on top of this picture? And apparently it's super easy to do. I'm not the person to do it. So I outsource that and I ask a lot of favors when it comes to that kind of thing.
And from what it sounds like, you have a lot of logistics, you know, with the equipment and permits, I imagine. How do you keep track of all that stuff? I mean, do you have a notebook or, you know, do you do something on your phone where you keep track of everything?
It is not my strong suit, if I'm being 100% authentic. Keeping track of all that stuff is not super easy for me. I have to go through like a very meticulous checklist for every single one. So that way I know that I have all of my certificates of insurance. Everybody's been added as additionally insured. Like the equipment has been rented and will be dropped off at 9 o'clock, which apparently in equipment time is 7 a.m. instead of 9 p.m. So, you know, it's just a lot of like kind of balancing all of these like crazy spinning plates. And it's not my favorite part. And I'm not very good at it. I wish that I had somebody else who was really good at it to do that. So if I hire, that's the kind of thing I would hire for right now.
And do you have to store all those documents?
Yeah, but it's on Drive. It's just okay. Google Drive has like made my life. I don't know how people did this ever before.
With filing cabinets, probably. With
filing cabinets. Oh, geez. And then trying to find a document, like one specific, what a nightmare. Even like accounting made so much easier through the internet.
So basically you just go in and you make a folder for each project and then dump everything into it.
Yep. And I'm sloppy about the way I dump it. And my operations director, Alina, always gets on me.
And does somebody go through and rename those things so that they have like some standardized naming scheme or something?
It makes it so much easier. It's just that level of minutia is like, makes me want to scratch my eyes out because I'd so much rather be like actually working on the mural or like coming up with ideas or like doing my pace when I get excited. And then to like have to like go back and rename all these fucking files, like that drives me up the wall because I'm like, this is a waste of my time. But it isn't ultimately like when I'm searching for this document again sometime in the future, it makes my life so much easier. And I just like have to pat myself on the back for grinning and bearing it.
And when you're painting, something that people probably wonder is, you know, if you normally somebody paints on canvas, they'll go buy, you know, a tube of acrylic or whatever. When you're painting a mural, what are you using? House paint? You know, like, what are you using?
We're using Benjamin Moore low sheen exterior, high grade house paint.
Wow. And so you're using the big brushes and all of that?
Yep. Or rollers or spray paint, just something that covers like a big amount of space. The one artist we work with, Jim Miner, he's amazing. He's incredible. He's a tattooist as well. He and because he's a tattooist, he came out there with the tiniest little brushes. And I was like, Jim, what are you doing? And he was like, I need to get in here. And I'm like, you are batshit crazy if you think we're doing any more of work with this teeny little brush. Details you can't even, so fine you can't even see them 5 feet out.
And how do you define, you know, how detailed you get on something? You know, is there a standard distance you go, okay, this is where the average person is going to view from?
It's kind of up to the artist. Like, however, you know, we don't pay them hourly. We give them one fat stipend, and it's like, you're going to commit to doing this design that you committed to doing. This is what I'm paying you. And you can extend that out to 4 weeks, or you can do it in two, but you're still getting paid the same.
What about you when you do them?
Like when I do murals, mm-hmm. I am pretty washy. Like I like thinned out paint, layered over and over again. I use really like high pigment stuff. And I am guilty of becoming too wrapped up in the details.
And when you say you're washy, so you're mixing it with water or with the cutter?
Usually just water. When you're out there and it's hot and, you know, we don't really have a lot of time to like mess around with these crazy little tinctures and stuff. So we usually just hose it down.
And since they're house paints, what's the resilience on these? I mean, like how long do they usually last?
About 10 years.
Wow. That's impressive.
It is. I think that when they're highly exposed to sunlight, like there's going to be some fading over time, but we usually clear coat everything. Helps with, you know, if there's any graffiti, which there's been ridiculously small amount of graffiti on the work that we do, but in just in case there is, we have a anti-graffiti coat, which is a sacrificial coat, and you just go out there with some soap and water and then reapply the sacrifice.
Oh, interesting. So it's not like a Teflon thing, it's just like something that you're going to wash away.
Yeah, it's a little soap and water should usually take it off, but then you have to you can do that 5 or 6 times in the same spot, and then you got to recoat.
And how did you learn about all this stuff? Did you just have to like somebody teach you? You had to like Google all this stuff about paint? Like where did the knowledge begin?
Kind of just jumping in, but asking other like people in industry, like, hey, what do you use when you do this? What do you use when you do this? And so it's a little bit of like collecting knowledge. And it's a little bit is kind of like, we know that this brand of paint fades in 6 years where this one will stay for 10. And it's just like, I am not ever afraid of like calling and asking dumb questions. So I have to call like South Bay Paints several times for a mural project and be like, hey, are we going to go with the Corotec, you know, like V45, or are we going to do the V50 this time? And then they'll give me like information, and I'm not afraid to ask dumb questions, and they're not that dumb anyways, because they're kind of specific and technical.
So in a way it's like being a contractor.
It is. It very much feels like that. And then our artists are, you know, we contract with them, but definitely knowing a little bit of everything, and you just can't be afraid to ask. And then if you don't know and you do the wrong thing or the dumb thing, then you're going to look like even more of an idiot.
And how are you managing all of your team interaction? You know, are you just text messaging, phone calls, emails, Slack?
Slack.
Really?
Yeah. We just actually... Congratulations to us. We just got all 30 of our artists on Slack, and they're so painfully unresponsive. but that's just artists, you know, they're so finicky and delicate and sensitive and beautiful and special, and everybody's different. And they don't always, you know, get back to us when we need them to get back to us. And it makes me really want to call back all the people I blew off when I was in like college and just after college and be like, hey, you know how 5 years ago it took me 3.5 weeks to respond to your email? I'm really sorry about that, because I feel like now I'm getting like my karma.
I know what you mean. I'm following up things for this show. I feel that daily.
Yeah.
When you were talking about your fellowship earlier, how did you get that? How did you get your fellowship?
Definitely by getting the first fellowship. So that was the second one that I've done. Yeah, it's the second one that I'd ever done. And I got it because I made a little video and I submitted it to this foundation or this organization. And then they picked me. And the Knight Foundation paid for my like a scholarship essentially. So I got to fly out to Vermont and hang out with all these other like rad urbanists from all around the country. So now I have all these amazing friends in like Detroit and Charlotte and Minneapolis. I've got all these cool friends that are doing really amazing work all across the country. And I just wrote an essay and then like made a little video and talked genuinely about myself and my goals and kind of what I want to do, like as a project, like kind of project-based stuff.
And for anybody listening that has no idea what a fellowship is, you want to kind of explain, especially since you've done a few of them?
Yeah. So I'm going to not Google it. So that I have a totally standard answer. A fellowship is like it's almost like a class, but you get selected for it. So it's kind of like, I don't know what, I guess going to the All-Stars or something like that, where you apply. And sometimes there's grant money. They'll pay you money to go do something. Or sometimes you pay them for this like very hands-on, very focused, experience. So for me doing with National Art Strategies, it was very much like, we talk about design-centered thinking and building for people first and, you know, what makes a park good, public spaces. Like, so it's kind of like all inclusive, like urbanism, urban planning, the idea about like thinking about human-centered design. So for me, that's what my fellowship means. That's what that fellowship was for me and probably for lots of other people. But I think that they do fellowships for like medical fellowships where I don't know what a medical fellowship would be, but it sounds gross.
So do you move somewhere for this or is it where you are?
I flew out to Vermont once and I flew out to, Toronto for another one. So usually it's just like a week in a nice hotel or in like a secluded retreat center in the rolling countryside hills of Vermont. So I still get to live. I still live here in San Jose. But I'll do like online classwork and stuff like that.
That must be one of the advantages of the internet, that they can do more of it remotely. I know that for a while they probably still have them, but there were fellowships where, you know, it's like 6 month or a year fellowship in blah, blah, blah.
Oh, that's a fancy one.
Yeah, those are intense, I'm sure. I mean, that's a big sacrifice. But I think maybe that's kind of what a medical fellowship would be. I think it's probably kind of like a residency type thing.
It is kind of like, yeah. I guess in a lot of ways it is kind of like a residency, but a residency you serve somewhere else.
What was that experience like? Like you said, it's kind of like a class, but I imagine it's different. You know, like, was it, do you feel like you were being trained or was it just kind of like pumping you with inspiration?
It's kind of both. Without feeling like, you know, bark twice for yes. And, you know, without that like official like training feel, but there is like a lot of opportunity to really like make these very human connections with other people. And that's the kind of thing that they want, because they want to grow, you know, a network of like entrepreneurial creatives who can bounce ideas off of each other from all over the place. But just to like, the first time I got to go on one, I felt like such a movie star. I felt like the coolest person in the whole world, because I got to like fly to Toronto and use my passport. And just like stay in a nice hotel, walk around, like learn all these like amazing things from these incredible people who I still adore. And it's just so, it was so like life for me. I want to be like, it was kind of life changing, because it kind of was.
And are those like the type of things that you put on a resume, you know, like you're going to, or like, for example, you're negotiating the building and you go, here's who I am. And you throw out the fellowships. Is that how it works afterwards?
I mean, definitely. Well, cause it kind of adds a little bit of clout, even if you don't know who National Art Strategies is. It's like a big word, like a big name, National Art Strategies. And so I definitely use it for stuff like that. I say I'm a Knight Fellow. I am a national, I'm a fellow for the, a creative community fellow with National Art Strategies. And it just, for me, it makes me feel like there's water, like there's something tangible that I have to show from that. That's not just like this silly little award in a little plastic sleeve.
Yeah, that could be, I imagine, can be kind of a difficult thing just being in the creative field, because so much of the creative field is intangible. You know,
yeah.
Like going up to meet somebody, you know, like somebody says, oh, I went to blah, blah, blah college, and then I went to Brown for law school. I don't even know if they have law school. my residence, or if you're a doctor, my residency was here. And, you know, there's all these things, you know, I belong to this club and that. For artists, we're kind of like, you know, well, I did art. I do art.
I haven't showed it to anybody. And
I painted 20 canvases, you know, like there's not the same kind of thing. So I can imagine that that adds a sort of a clout that's missing.
There's a little validity in it for sure. And especially because then I use that to get more. Yeah, like when I had to give my bio in like a grant application or something like that, they're like, oh, we know National Art Strategies, like the people that are kind of in this like industry, like they know what National Art Strategy is, like they know what Knight Arts is. And so for me to even just like have that, to be able to name drop a little bit here and there, definitely adds. And if you don't know who it is, then it just sounds really good.
So what is, I mean, this is kind of a big question, but like, what is your goal? Like, what are you moving towards with all the things you're doing? What's your ultimate like pie in the sky?
I think two things on that. First, I really try hard. Like, I think goals are important and we should all be working towards being better people and having goals, but also like, kind of like fuck that a little bit, because I would hate to like, this is what I always say to myself, like in a year, my goals are going to probably have shifted, because I like that flexibility, and I don't let like younger Aaron tell older Aaron what to do. So for me, like setting up these expectations, I have a little bit of a goal, but it's kind of like, it's a pretty loosey goosey goal. And I like it that way because I want it to be able to change as resources shift, as knowledge shifts, as like the landscape of San Jose is changing. But then the other part of that, the other hat says that one of my biggest goals is to, work through like advocacy and like policy change around artists' live workspaces. I think that would be super cool. So eventually I'd like to have property that, is in San Jose in downtown, where I have space for artists to live and work, and for to really change the idea of what it means to be a community center. Because I think that building community is the only way that San Jose is going to maintain authenticity through this whole change, this whole like landscape change that we're going through. And I want to be a part of that conversation. So ultimately I want to have like a center, like that would be the tangible part of it. To have live workspace, community center, performing arts, murals, public art, kind of like all in one little area. But I don't know if I'll even be satisfied with, I don't know if I'll ever be satisfied with what I do, but yeah, I guess that's my current goal, is to find a permanent space to, I mean, all of this local color stuff, it was always meant as a prototype. We have an end date. That end date will be sometime in the next 6 months or so. And then my new job is to go for Local Color 2.0, which is, instead of being this like, still focuses on interim use, but will allow us to kind of build up capital to buy real estate.
When you say that you want to redefine what it means to be a community center, what do you think like people think of as a community center now? And how do you think that needs to change?
I think that the term is just dusty, and I can't think of like a more relevant, I've been racking my brain for 2 years trying to think of something else that's not the term community center. just because I think that the term is a little dusty.
Kind of feels like a place when you hear it, you're like, that's where the seniors are going to go to do yoga. And, you know, they're going to, every once in a while they'll have, it kind of feels whitewashed, doesn't it?
And that's part of it too, I think. Cause like I'm half Mexican. I didn't grow up going to like a community center or anything like that. But there's something about the term community center that just, I don't know. It rubs me. It feels too clinical.
Yeah, like it's planned or something.
Forced and planned a little bit. And so I've been racking my brain to try to come up with a new term for it. And I don't know. But the way that I want to kind of work in the redefining.
Yeah, redefinition. Like,
redefinition. I just make up words when I don't know. Sometimes it works. I don't know. Cause like I don't want to like knock on like other community centers, right? Like that's the goal. I'm not trying to hate on like Roosevelt or that one that's in the Hensley district. I can't remember off the top of my head, but oh, you know what it is that they feel city, they feel bureaucratic, they feel city run. They feel like a rentable little venue. All things that I want to do minus the city run part, but do it like really, really cool.
Yeah, I think like you said, it's not about knocking community centers for what they do. It's more just like the term, when we hear that term, it makes us think of the way that they are now. And it sounds like you want to do something that maybe appeals to a broader spectrum of the community. It feels like current community centers, while they do serve wonderful purposes, are kind of more focused towards children, families, and the elderly.
Yeah, I definitely think that I feel that way. But that's because I haven't stepped foot in a community center like in years, you know?
Right. For all we know, they could be awesome.
Yeah. Here I am talking shit, and I haven't even gone in like 10 years, probably.
It's a weird thing, though. I mean, that's something that we carry with us. It's like there's just words have connotations, and sometimes you can't get over, even though the reality might be different, just the connotation of that term. I think most people listening can agree that that's kind of what they imagine too.
Yeah. I want to gear it really towards semi-youth. I want it to be really focused on like, not necessarily people my age, but like for aspiring producers, like people who are already doing stuff, not necessarily, I'm going to bite my tongue on this one, but not necessarily like students, but like actual practicing artists, producers, printers, people who just need that like one leg up to be able to have like a cool place to perform or to make artwork, but also aren't going to be able to afford like these like fancy studios that pop up from time to time. I think that just makes it like inherently a cooler demographic. So it's just like the relevance is there. And I want to be able to provide space for emerging producers, emerging artists, all these cool people who they need these kinds of subsidies in order to be creative. And I think without it, then San Jose is going to could be a really boring place in like 5 years or 10 years when some of the older producers kind of age out, older promoters age out, some of the older artists, you know? I think that if we aren't providing these cool creative spaces for people to do these things, then we're going to be pretty devoid of interesting things happening.
I think that is an important point because part of when, if you're anybody listening is probably, I would say, over the age of 25. You might kind of remember the world before the way it is now, when there were bookstores and there were record stores and, you know, they were independent and they were weird, or they're little, you know, like head shops and things like that in cities. Now, when you go to, now there's going to be a bunch of people going to disagree with me that there are still cities that have this, and I'm sure. But when you go to San Jose, we don't have any of that stuff anymore. I was downtown. I actually had a meeting with Daniel from Content. We had coffee and we were hanging out. And then actually we saw you. I'll get back to that in a second. he left. And so I was like, oh, I might as well just spend a little bit of time downtown. I started walking around. I'm like, oh my God, there's nothing to do. Unless I want to eat or go into a business, there's literally nothing for me to do here.
And that sucks. I think that that sucks. I wish that we could keep our hours more open and, you know, like I love the idea that you can come in and do something for free. We just don't have that. And I think it's so, so vital. And when that initial barrier of like, even just like walking into a gallery or walking into, you know, like a place that doesn't feel like it's yours. Like sometimes galleries feel a little stuffy or they feel a little pretentious. And maybe like some of our mentally ill community don't feel like it's okay for them to walk into the space. But this is a space that like anybody can walk in, anybody can walk through, as long as you're not being like violent or disrespectful, like come on in, you know? And I don't think that there are any other places in San Jose where you can kind of do that, except for maybe the library.
I guess it's a good time for you maybe to kind of break down even more what happens at Local Color. I mean, we've kind of sketched out the idea of what Local Color is, but you want to really explain to people what it is?
Yes. So it is unlike anything San Jose has currently. We are open studios. So we are, depending on who I'm talking to, it's a creative co-working space. Or if I'm talking to an artist, it's a bunch of shared art studios in a 20,000 square foot box. It's just big, empty building with no poles or rooms or anything. It's just like a big box with art studios in the back. And the front half is like kind of San Jose themed performance and community space. So we have a mural arts wall. You know, we are a mural arts nonprofit. I guess we're a couple of different things nonprofit now, but we started as a mural arts nonprofit, and it's important that we have a space where the community can come out, paint whatever the hell they want on the wall, and then we white it out like every, I don't know, 2 weeks or something like that. We have a gallery, but more than a gallery, we really wanted to focus on the studio spaces being open and public and accessible, because I think that outside of traditional gallery space, I really wanted to focus on San Jose's history of manufacturing, you know, because we're a agricultural manufacturing kind of city. And I think that the creation of things is like the workmanship that San Jose is known for. And I think that that's innovation, and like providing these spaces for artists is, I mean, if you can't tell, it's really, really close to my heart. And I also think that by walking through, you're seeing artwork in different stages of complete. And I think that when you see kind of the slow progression of art being made, it fosters empathy for the arts. So that way, when I'm charging you, you know, $1,500 for a canvas, you know that I spent $1,500 worth of hours on it.
And what's really interesting about the way that it, at least the back section looks, is it's kind of like, I can't really put my description on an exact description, but it's almost like a trade show, you know, like everybody has a booth. And, yeah, you know, like Drew's is like, he's doing that sports theme stuff right now. So like he has that AstroTurf down, and like, you know, he's got the Wheaties boxes that he's painted and all that. But then you have Jeremiah's space, which is just like canvases stacked, and it looks just like a studio. So Drew's is like more of a stall, you know, like a sales stall. And it's really fascinating, like, concept.
Yeah, we had, there were a couple of us, me, Drew, Ben, and George, all, well, they started it. These guys, the three boys started it. And so they wanted to have each artist space, like, have a theme to it. So that way, like, you walk through and you're like getting little glimpses into like a art studio themed sports, I don't know, like sports something, sports arena, like trophy case. It's like kind of everything, you know? And like Ben is his famous sign painter, surprisingly. George has like VTA themed stuff. So he's got like this cool like transit feel. And then mine, I wanted to do like a little shop of horrors, but with flowers and just kind of like in my aesthetic. So there are a couple of us who are trying to build out our spaces to be more like how do you say this? It's almost like we wanted them to be like art studios, but like really funky and everyone like different and unique. So it's not like an art studio themed art studio. It's like a transit themed or like witchy alchemist themed kind of space.
Kind of like those themed hotels, you know, like tonight I'm going to stay in the medieval room.
The caveman room. Yeah. So it's like the Madonna Inn of creativity.
Or the Yellow Submarine. Every door takes you to a different world.
Yeah, like, what is that show people really like?
Doctor Who.
Doctor Strange. It's a different one. Or, you know, where it's just like you go in. I assume this is what happens. You go into this blue thing and then it zaps you to, I don't know, the 20s or something. I've never seen the show.
It's bigger on the inside.
It's kind of, did you read House of Leaves?
No, I haven't.
Oh, so good. It's about a house whose interior dimensions are larger than its exterior dimensions. And it's kind of like a really scary version of that concept.
It's funny that you bring that up because I usually end every episode of Creative Minds asking, what book do you think that I should read next?
Oh, I'm ahead of you.
Is that the book that you would recommend?
I feel like it has to be now just because it's so... It's so scary and it's so weird and it's unlike anything I've ever read before. It's almost like a choose your own adventure. The layout of it is just, it's fascinating. So for no real intellectual value, but just for like, just to be like involved, it's like a participatory read.
It correct me if I'm wrong. It's like, you have to read it in paper, right? It wouldn't work in an ebook format, right?
Yeah, you have to. And you just like engage with the book in a different way. Like the book, it becomes like a physical thing. It is a physical thing, but you know, like it becomes something that you're like actively engaged in. I got so scared reading it. I was reading it at Good Karma and yeah, granted, I probably had a couple of those grapefruit IPAs. But I was reading the book and I was so scared of the book that I had to like sit in it. We had barrels outside at the time. I had to like sit in this barrel and like think for a little bit, but the book is, it's nuts. It's really, it's fun. It's a fun, fun read, but it's scary.
And I want to go back to one thing real quick that you mentioned that I think would be important considering all the things we talked about. You mentioned policy change. What do you think that policy change needs to be?
I think one of the biggest issues that we have in San Jose is our housing. And I think that we need affordable housing. And I think that that's almost like bottom line to so many issues in San Jose. And I see that with a lot of the artists that I work with, that they're pretty underhoused. Like they, you know, I've got guys who are sleeping on couches. I got guys who are like, you know, doubled up in rooms and stuff like that with other buddies or with family members, especially. And it breaks my heart that I have these like mid 20s kids who can't afford a place to live. So they get sardined into family homes or in, you know, on a couch with a bud. And I think ultimately the bottom line comes back to affordable housing. And it's something that I wish I could be more engaged in. I'm just not as passionate about housing as I am about the arts. And I think ACE is in their places. So eventually I'm going to build up to kind of thinking about rezoning an area or try to rezone an area. I have this vision of this like adorable trailer park. I grew up in a trailer park and I think that they're magical. And I just want to be able to incorporate some of these like visions that I have around the arts and housing together. And that would make me feel like I did something with my life.
Do you want to tell everybody listening now that they've heard all about you, who you are exactly and what you do and where they can find you?
So we're pretty active on Instagram under Local Color SJ. Same with Facebook. Me personally, I'm an artist and I'm a creator and I'm on Instagram at mauves, MAUV.ES, which is my favorite color. And yeah, I guess Facebook, Instagram, all that good stuff. And then Local Color is located at 27 South First Street. So we are right on the corner of Santa Clara and First, or nearly on the corner. And we're open Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in the evenings.
I've been trying out a new podcast app, and they're not paying me to say this, but it's called CastBox. It's kind of cool because you can comment and heart episodes, so it brings more of a social aspect to it. So you might want to check that one out, or maybe you still prefer to use Overcast, or you like Castro, or maybe you're just using the Apple Podcast app. It doesn't really matter where you listen to this show. I'm just glad that you listen, and I would really appreciate that whatever app you're using in, if there's a way to review, to comment, or to give a thumbs up or a star to this show, that you take the time to do that so that other people know that this show is something that you enjoy, so that maybe they can check it out too.